Hello, I'm Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 19 of the Sex and Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is Moses and the problem of the Torah. That's kind of a controversial title, the problem of the Torah. The basis for it is actually a number of different events that have been taking place recently in my own circumstances. One is that I'm currently teaching an evening course at Rutgers University on the Hebrew Bible, and we've just recently finished dealing with our section on Moses. Another event in fairly recent times that causes me to think about this particular topic is the popularity of Bruce Feiler's book, American Prophet, or America's Prophet, the best-selling book about Moses and his role in the American imagination. So these two things bring together a concern that has been developing for quite some time in my thoughts about Moses, and that is that Moses has taken on a role that is in some ways disproportionate to what we actually know about him and has forever changed the way that we think about the Bible. Let me explain a little bit. Moses is not a historically attested person. To be historically attested, most historians would agree that an individual must be mentioned in at least two sources that are not dependent on each other. That is to say, if Moses was mentioned in the Bible and another ancient source contemporary with the time frame that he is normally dated, somewhere, say, in the 13th century BCE, then he could be considered historical. That would mean that there would be two non-biased sources that point to his historical veracity. Now, if a person is only mentioned in one historical source, as is the case of Moses, and that historical source is sometimes biased towards a non-historical interpretation, such as the Bible, then calling him historical in any real sense of the word is somewhat problematic. We have no external records to the Bible or sources based on the Bible that mention Moses as a historical individual. We don't know anything about him if he actually lived. And the story of his life is largely based on events that may have taken place with other individuals. For example, the story of Moses' birth, that he is born in Egypt during a time, which again is not historically attested, that the Egyptians were killing off baby boys for their foreign slaves, the Hebrews or Israelites, and that his mother put him in a basket made of rushes and put him on the River Nile to be found later by the Pharaoh's daughter and raised in the royal palace. This story has clear antecedents going back to the story of Sargon, the first world emperor that we know of, the first emperor in the world, I should say, Sargon of Akkad, somewhere around 2300 BCE, that is to say, a full millennium before Moses, when he writes about his own birth story, or has his own story recounted. Sargon tells about how his mother, fearing for his life, put him in a basket, set him on a river, and he was later, of course, found and became king. Now, the similarity of these stories tend to show that what we have in the Exodus account of Moses is more an account of a legendary figure who becomes special through the machinations of the gods and ultimately becomes an important individual for the people that he is associated with. Now, Moses goes on throughout his career to become the leader of the Israelites out of Egypt in the Exodus. And as the story progresses, he is the one who brings the Torah down from Mount Sinai. And so in the narrative of the Bible, in the self-contained narrative of the Bible, what we have is the story of Moses bringing the Torah, or the Ten Commandments, the law, whatever you want to call it, down Mount Sinai for Israel to have, and from that day on, they have the Torah to live by. Now, interestingly enough, it seems that historically speaking, the Torah has its origins with the advent of the Persians. This is, of course, several centuries after Moses is supposed to have lived. The Persians conquered the ancient world and became a truly sort of universal empire around about the year 539-538 BCE. And one of the things that the Persians did is they allowed their captive peoples to return home. In other words, if you had been exiled by the Babylonians, or if you had somehow managed to survive the exile of the Assyrians a few centuries earlier, you were allowed to go back to your homeland. The idea was that in gratitude for being allowed to return home, people would not be inclined to revolt against the Persians. They would think of them kindly. And in addition to allowing people to return home from their exiled status or their diaspora status, the Persians also encouraged the people that they were in charge of, the people that they had now won control of from the Babylonians. They encouraged these people also to come up with their own law codes so that they would have a sense of self-governance. And it's at this point in time that we start to hear about Ezra, who is the last character in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, called a prophet. And he at this time returns to Judah from exile with the Torah in hand. Now, if we stop to look at it in this light, we realize that if you read the prophets, the great spokespeople of the ways and mind of Yahweh throughout the monarchic period when there was a kingdom in Israel, that these prophets do not refer to the Torah as a reason for why Israel should be straightening its ways. They have various concerns that they address, and they do have many issues that they raise with the people of Israel. But when they do this, they don't say, you should change your ways because the Torah demands it, or the Torah says you should respond this way, or the Torah says this is what God demands of you. In other words, when people needed to know what God wanted of them, according to the Hebrew Bible, during the monarchic period, they found that out through the mediation of prophets. They did not turn to a written source. It was not there for them. There was no Torah for them to read. So what they did is they referred to the prophets. Now, prophets are a difficult group of people to deal with because it's never possible to tell if someone is really being sincere as a prophet or not. And so one of the biggest problems with prophecy in the biblical world is that you could never say whether one prophet who tells you to do A is correct when there's another prophet saying to do B instead. And you don't know which one God has sent because there's no way to test that. There's no empirical way to determine whether or not God has told a prophet to say one thing or another, or in other words, who's a false prophet and who's a true prophet. So it's into this mix of not having a Torah, yet needing prophetic guidance, that the character of Moses takes on special prominence. Moses is presented as the first true prophet in the Hebrew Bible. When he escapes Egypt after murdering an Egyptian, according to the story in Exodus, he comes to Mount Sinai where he receives a prophetic commission. Of course, this is the famous story of the burning bush, and everybody knows it from Cecil B. DeMille's version of the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston playing the unforgettable Moses. But in any case, when on Mount Sinai, Moses receives a prophetic commission, and that prophetic commission is repeated by many other prophets later on in the Hebrew Bible. When they want to legitimize their own role as prophet, they do it by comparing themselves to Moses, who is the first and prototypical prophet. And so what we have developing in the Bible is this idea of Moses as the prototypical prophet who also brings the law to Israel. And when we read the books of Samuel and Kings, the historical books of Israel, we tend to think of it in modern terms as a simple historical record, but that's to misunderstand what the books are doing. These books were written closer to the time when the southern kingdom of Judah had finally succumbed to the Babylonians, and they were asking themselves a question. If the Israelites were indeed the chosen people, if God chose them, and if God allowed for them to have a monarchy, indeed, one of the hallmarks of the history of Israel is the memory of David as the great king. And so if God had chosen the monarchy for them as a means of governing themselves, then why did the kingdom ultimately fail? Why did the kingdom fall? How could the Assyrians or the Babylonians conquer them if they were indeed divinely chosen? Now, this is one of the big issues that the Israelites have to ask. And one of the answers they come up with is that they were defeated because they refused to obey Torah. They had not lived by the laws of Torah. And in order for that to happen, Moses has to become the mediator of Torah for them. He is the one who brings the Torah down from the mountain, and so they have it from the very beginning. And all they have to do throughout the long history of Israel in the Promised Land is to look. They can look at the book and see what they're supposed to do. Historically, though, that's not really what happens. The Torah comes quite a bit later in the record. Indeed, after the prophets had flourished and ceased to exist. The prophets give God's message. The people don't know for sure which prophet is legitimate and which one is not. The only way you can tell is after the event. As I said earlier, if one prophet says to do A and another says to do B, the only solution the Hebrew Bible can come up with as to which is the legitimate prophet actually has to take place after the event occurs. So if you do A and it doesn't turn out, then that prophet was wrong. If you do B and it turns out, well, that prophet was right. The problem about this kind of way of dealing with policy is that if you don't know which prophet is legitimate to begin with, you're really kind of stuck. You have to make a decision and try to live with that. And if you've chosen the wrong prophet, then there's just no way around it. You've simply made a mistake and you have to pay the consequences for it. And so in trying to understand this whole situation, Moses takes on a role that is heroic in nature. He sort of fits the character of the hero with a thousand faces that Joseph Campbell popularized some years ago as the character who gives the clear answers. And I think that even though I don't agree with everything that Fahler says in his book, this I think is probably the reason that Moses has such an appeal for Americans is that he gives clear answers in the Torah. And we've seen that in the last couple of presidential administrations prior to that of Barack Obama, that people have often voted for the candidate who is willing to give them clear, if misguided, answers. We as a society like clear answers. We like to know in black and white what God requires of us. And so it becomes an issue because Americans like to have the quick and easy answer, whereas the biblical story presents a much more complex picture, a picture where the Torah, which is the necessary information, is not given until the end of the story. That's the dilemma the Israelites face, and it ultimately leads to what becomes the downfall of Jerusalem and the chosen people and the chosen city, only to be restored once Ezra shows up on the scene with the book written that has the laws written in black and white so that the will of God can be known without any doubt. I think that's why America likes Moses.